Hi, I'm Amanda Borchel-Dunn. Welcome to the Times of Israel Daily Briefing.
Your update on what's important in Israel, the Middle East, and the Jewish world. Hi everyone and welcome to the Times of Israel Daily Briefing. It's March the 8th, 2021. I'm Rao Wootliff, the regular producer of the show, but sitting in today for our wonderful regular host, Amanda Borchel-Dunn. And I'm delighted to be joined today on International Women's Day by Times of Israel Ops and Blogs editor Miriam Hirschlag and the editor-in-chief of our Hebrew sister site, Zman Yisrael, Berenit Goren. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, Raul. Happy International Women's Day. Hi, Bira.
Hi, Miriam. Hi, Raul. Thank you for having me.
On today's show, we have a slightly different lineup to normal. We're going to be focusing on what International Women's Day means both globally and in Israel. I'll be asking our two guest editors their personal considerations in boosting female voices. And we'll be taking a look at three posts on the Times of Israel's blog platform. They each tell a fascinating story about the place of women in Israel and the Jewish world today. So let's begin. International Women's Day was first marked in New York in 1909, 112 years ago, by the International Socialist Women's Conference, and over the years has become a focal point in the movement for women's rights. I want to start by asking you, Miriam, what you think the day means globally.
Well, it's an opportunity to look at where we are, how far we've come, how far we have not come, and shine a light on very often on data. It's, you know, a time when we can look at what have been the usual metrics for women's progress, which is equality in payment. For many, it's a question of abortion and or reproductive rights and where that's being moved. It's simply a time when we can take a look and maybe celebrate some of the achievements of individual women as well.
And Berenit, how do you think the day is recognized or marked in Israel?
Well, I think, you know, Israel is probably lagging behind some of the Western world, not necessarily all of it, but I think for us, it's right now, at least, more to the basics of it. It's looking at women's protection as far as violence against women in the family goes. It's looking at women's progression in the workplace, pay equality. We're at the point where we've already given women's rights, but you know, you got to figure out that in Israel, about a third of the population is communities where women do not have any kind of equality. I mean, whether it's the Orthodox community or whether it's the conservative Arab, Bedouin, etc. communities. So in that respect, there's a very, very marked difference between what you would see being celebrated as Women's Day in Tel Aviv and how Women's Day is celebrated, if at all, in some of the conservative environments.
In many places in Israel, Women's Day has sort of become a day to maybe give gifts to women. I remember when I used to work at the Knesset, there was a gift that was of, I think, some soaps that was specifically only for the women. And after some complaints, they allowed men to take them for their partners.
I have to say something. I will not say my age, but I am well of age. And I've never received a gift for Women's Day. So
me neither, man. I want some soaps. I want me some soaps.
Exactly.
So tell me, each of you lead platforms with a range of different voices on them. How do you approach the challenge of boosting female voices today in 2021?
So for me, there's two ways. One is to be open and aware of and proactive about reaching out to interesting women to write on my platform. Just to give some background, the blogging platform is a very open platform and people come on and they write. Every day we feature several voices. So if you want the metaphor, it would be that our featured posts are more like an op-ed page. And that's where I have more control and I have also data. I don't really have a way to tell you out of 1,000 posts per month what the gender breakdown is, but I can easily look at the 100 or so that we promote and tell you. And I'm very conscious of it. For the last 3 years, I have done a monthly tally of the gender breakdown. And right now we are running at 42% women's voices, which I felt was a failure until I started looking at the breakdown on other platforms, major platforms like the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, where up until fairly recently, until say the New York Times decided as a policy to go for parity, the proportion was, as of several years ago on the New York Times, 13% were women's voices in op-eds. So that's one area. The other area is that I mix up what it is that we are reading about, because the subject matter really changes the gender distribution. And we're going to talk about that when we get to some of the posts. But if we are opening this up and saying that voices that are talking about issues that have been more associated with women, domestic issues in particular, and that these actually have great importance, that also changes the mix and gives women a stronger spotlight, just simply by saying the experience of a woman trying to raise children in a pandemic together with her partner as well has great importance. So those are the two ways.
Now, Berenit Zaman Yisrael has been active now for nearly 2 years. Can you tell us some of your editorial considerations?
Look, I mean, the issue of gender parity and the issue of having a heterogeneous team of writers is something that I live and breathe and think about every day, and I fail with every day. It's very hard to do current affairs and to cover politics and to cover social affairs with a decision that you're going to break down what you do based on gender. It's not every day that you're going to be able to somehow align things and say, okay, I'm going to have an interview with a male politician and an interview with a female politician. You're not able to do that. You go with the flow of what's happening out there. And if there's a, for that matter, if there's a military issue like Iran, then we go out of our way to find female voices that have something to say about it, but we will never reach parity because that's the reality of it, sadly. And I'm not going to be able to fix that reality worldwide just by the way that I cover the world. So I can't say that we do everything specific. I don't count in the way that, you know, that Miriam said she doesn't know. I don't do this either. I don't count how many stories per day we have that are gender specific in that way or another. I don't actually decide whether to hire a person based on their gender. However, having said that, we live and breathe this. I'm a woman. I'm the editor-in-chief of the website. My deputy editor is a woman. My chief political correspondent, you know, one of the most sought-after correspondents, is a woman. I've wooed her to come and join us, Tal Schneider, for a long time, not because she's a woman, but because she's a leader in her field. And the fact that she's a woman makes me happy, because for me, it's almost like an afterthought, and that's how it should be. So I celebrate Women's Day every day by working with these incredible women.
Hi, it's Sarah Tuttle Singer from the Times of Israel. Come join our community and support fast and fair independent journalism. You can sign up with the link at the bottom of every single article on the site.
I want to take a look at these three posts that Miriam has picked out for us. We start with what I just think is a lovely post by Callie Rubin Kislowitz named Planting an Audrey. Miriam, do you want to tell us a little bit about this particular post?
Yes. So this was published a few weeks ago, and it's a charming and really funny piece by a woman named Kelly Rubin Kislowitz. She's a woman, a mother, originally from Cleveland. She lives in Efrat. And the story is that she took up gardening. You know, it's either that, right, or making sourdough bread these days. And she was growing these pepper plants, and one of them was just doing splendidly, and she was as proud as can be. And then it was discovered by her children that, in fact, this splendid plant that she thought was a pepper plant was a weed. And she writes, I had been watering, repotting, and over-identifying with a weed. Audrey, which is the name she gave to this plant, is never going to grow into a pepper. She will never graduate pepper school with honors and become part of a stir fry. I was devastated. My kids cried with laughter because they are horrible people. This is a post with such warmth that it goes on to talk about lessons and wisdom that you can gain from making these kind of mistakes. And it's full of humor. And so in itself, it's just a little charming read. And I think in a bigger sense, it shines a light on how this pandemic has moved things inside the domestic space. And that's a space that is very much, you know, where women are prominent, if not dominant. Well, in fact, dominant. And it, to me, rhymes with, it's not the same as saying that the personal is political, which was a statement made 50 years ago by activists in women's liberation in the United States. It's saying also the private becomes public. And I think we've seen that happen so much as we move our lives indoors and our work and all of the kind of burdens and delights of trying to run households becomes so much part of the focus. And so in that way, women's voices have just moved forward in a really interesting way. Obviously, not in all good ways. You know, not everybody is planting plants and growing sourdough bread. Some women are experiencing the uptick in domestic violence that has been widely reported here. And so also that. And in that sense, all of these divisions are being eroded between what we thought was private or personal or public or political.
Now, Bira, in Israel, there's been a lot of focus on some of the different sectoral groups over the pandemic and how they've been affected. How do you think the pandemic has affected women's place in Israel?
Oh, I think this is the most important point to bring up. And it's not just in Israel, it's all over the world. But I think we're probably feeling it just a little slightly more. The number one sector to be hit by the coronavirus are women. There are actually statistics that say that the pandemic has taken us approximately 50 years backwards. The number of women who are unemployed is approximately 3 to 4 times more than men. Women have, you know, as far as lockdowns go, women have carried the burden of having to work from home, take care of children who have not seen school in days. There is already some research showing that women will not go back to work once things reopen and when things are back to sort of normal. They're not going to go back to workplace. We're going to be back a few decades, in fact, as far as how long we've gone. And that really worries me. Now, when you talk about the Israeli politics, when you do not have women sitting at the table, when you have a cabinet taking care of the coronavirus and there isn't a single woman around the table from the, you know, no minister sitting there, or there's a single woman and none of them are parents in that respect, you know, there's no mother sitting there, then yeah, that actually has a major effect. The fact that economy, as important as obviously it is, has taken a lead, and opening businesses has taken a lead over education, is 100% a result of that. I have no doubt that if we had a female prime minister who has kids in school, it would have looked completely different.
And with that, I think we'll move on to another post that Miriam, you picked out, by Professor Ofer Koenig from the Israel Democracy Institute, on the actual facts and the hard numbers of where Israel is in terms of women's involvement in politics.
Right. Well, here I should say that maybe women's organizations should build a statue to Levi Eshkol, the only person who ever managed to put a woman in at the top. He did this by dying of a heart attack in 1969. And that apparently is the only way you can get a woman to be head of state in Israel. This post gives a comparative that puts Israel in very poor light. Ofer Koenig is at the Israel Democracy Institute, and that's a place where they are crunching the numbers, which I love, because that, I think, gives us some great clarity on what we already feel to be true. And, you know, this, the last time and the first time we had one, a woman, a female head of state, was 1974. But it goes further than that. And they look at women in the cabinet and women in the Knesset. And women in the cabinet, 9% of all cabinet members throughout the history of Israel have been women. And of those, none have been what are considered to be the two most important portfolios, apart from prime minister, which are finance and defense. And as far as the Knesset goes, so we are at 30%. We've been hovering around that number for the last 7 years. So this is an indictment of Israeli society.
I just want to correct Miriam with regards to those pitiful numbers. You said we have 30% women representation in the Knesset. Actually, we don't. We have 30 members of parliament. That makes up for 25% of the Knesset. So it's even worse than what you think.
Right. And I want to emphasize this.
This is the highest we've ever had. So the good news is it's going up. The bad news is it's still only one of four. And I think when you look at the shift that Israel is going through, there's good news that's lying in it. Part of the reason that we had so few women all throughout the years is because Israel has a history of electing members of parliament that come through mainly from the army, from the field of the army and business, both of which have been and still are dominated by men. So women coming in usually had less chances to go into the top and take part in parliament. So the good news is that's changing. We are seeing less interest in the public towards generals. There is more emphasis and more likeness to women who are activists, who are social activists, and therefore there's more chance for women to fit in. Labor Party is now the only party that we have that has a female leader. But the fact that once Mirav Mikhaeli was elected head of Labor, she more than doubled the number of seats in the polls, at least, for her party is good news. There's something to look at and to hope for.
And in terms of the effect of women in these positions of influence on the real politic in Israel, we have another fascinating post, Miriam, that you've picked out by Susan Weiss from the Center for Women's Justice.
This post was published on Aguna Day, which is right before Purim, and it marks the activists drawing attention to this deep and painful problem we have in Israel, in which women get stuck in marriages because their estranged husbands do not grant them a halachic divorce, a bill of divorce, which is called a get. And so we have these painful situations in which women are trapped or chained in marriages that they don't want to be in. This post by Susan Weiss actually brings three cases where there were chinks in the armor of this seemingly insurmountable problem, and cases were resolved through public pressure. And so it's a call to action in the arena of public pressure for these cases. I should say I picked this as an example of the incredibly thriving and rich content offering we have on Times of Israel that addresses the intersection between society and halakha, Jewish law. And that has to do with our very, very engaged Orthodox readership. This also crosses into other areas of interest, such as women's rights and equality. But I would just say we have just this tremendous amount of conversation about what's going on with women in Judaism. And I've thought for many years that the question of women in Jewish life is always both a question about women and also a question about Judaism. Whenever there are splits, it's very often signified by a disagreement over women's roles and women's rights. And those splits go deeper into other different disagreements in Judaism, and it's always been a fascinating part of what we publish on the blogs.
Absolutely, and that's all we've got time for today. I want to say it's been an absolute pleasure to host both of you on today's podcast, and I wish you both a happy Women's Day with or without gifts.
Thank you.
Thanks, Raoul.
We want soap.
Soap.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. A special thanks to our producer, Raoul Woodliff. I'm Amanda Borshaldan.
You can find us daily wherever you get your podcasts.
And on our mothership, thetimesofisrael.com.